Liberty.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. How long has the federal government been lying to you and me? Now, not necessarily entirely to the people who earn over $1 million a year and can figure this stuff out and read Fortune in the Wall Street Journal regularly, but to the average American, how long have they been lying to us in order to impoverish the middle class, wipe out people on Social Security, and destroy labor unions? I think it's a very appropriate question on this election day. It is, of course, Tuesday, the 20th of May, and tonight the returns will be coming in from Kentucky and Oregon. I'm broadcasting live here from Oregon. In fact, in the third hour of our show, Ellen Ratner is going to drop by. She's with the Talk Radio News Service. She's in town to report for her stations and whatnot live from Oregon about the Oregon returns. And it'll be great to see Ellen, Louise Nail. Go out and have some lunch with her afterwards. But how long has this been going on? I've had a number of people call into the program over the last 6 years, that we're now in our sixth year doing this program in this time period, noon to three Eastern time, and ask, how is it that you know, people, in particularly on Social Security or on fixed incomes, pensions, things like that, say, you know, how is it that I'm supposed to be getting a cost of living adjustment every year, and I do, you know, and it's supposed to reflect inflation, but 15 years ago, 20 years ago, I could actually live on what that was, and now I can't anymore. Now I'm having to choose between medications and food, or between food and dog food, or pay the rent, or live in the car, kind of thing. I mean, it's how is that? How did it come about? In fact, there are some really startling statistics out there. Mike Whitney wrote this, and Danny Schechter quoted it in a piece over at Common Dreams, but Mike Whitney wrote this piece, and this sounds like, you know, just total conspiracy nut stuff. He says, the financial crisis we now face was created by design. It was intended to destroy the labor movement, crush the middle class, quash Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and reduce our foreign debt by 50 to 60%, forcing a restructuring of America's debt, privatize all our public assets and resources, and create a new regime of austerity measures which will divert more wealth to the banking and corporate establishment. Fact of the matter is, he's right. There is no conspiracy nut to that. It's absolutely true. It was part of the Reagan agenda. It has been followed scrupulously since the Reagan administration. It's even been, I mean, it was even done during the Clinton administration. And Kevin Phillips laid it out brilliantly, frankly, in an article that's in the current issue of Harper's. And this is the May 2008 issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called Numbers Racket by Kevin Phillips. And I highly recommend that you check this thing out. He points out, first of all, that over the last 25 years, the effect of rigged numbers, of jiggled numbers, the effect of this has been to make it seem like we're wealthier than we are. In fact, he says, you know, just imagine what the political consequences would be. He says, if the media over the past 5 years have been citing 8% unemployment instead of 5%, 5% inflation instead of 2%, an annual average growth in the 1% range instead of 3 to 4%, well, you know, it would be political suicide for the party in power. And yet that's what it has been. When you look at the actual real numbers, and he's got the charts and graphs here, right now, if we were to use the criteria that was used in 1983, the second year of the Reagan administration, when the jiggling of these numbers really went onto steroids. So let's just go back to 83. You look at using the 83 way, the way that inflation was calculated from the 19-teens until 1983, today's inflation rate would be 12%. That's what the real inflation, but the government says it's only 4% per year. In fact, last year they were saying, you know, officially it was less than 2%. When, in fact, last year it was just a little under 10%. Now, how do they get away with this? This is the other question that people often call in and ask. How is it the politicians get away with this? And again, I refer you to Bob Herbert's piece in today's New York Times, Bob Herbert's op-ed. He says, you know, in this presidential election, let's hope it's not about Willie Horton or guns, gays, and God and that kind of thing. Let's talk about what's actually going on in America. Let's talk about the real serious economic issues. You know, the slogan of the unofficial internal slogan of the Clinton campaign in 1992 was, it's the economy, stupid. And it really needs to be again. But how did this come about? Well, Kevin Phillips lays it out, and it's absolutely startling. He talks about how in 2003, an economist from the University of Chicago, ironically enough, because this is where Milton Friedman is from, the guy who arguably began the economic insanity that Reagan brought with him to our country. Austin Goolsbee is his name. He's now an advisor to Barack Obama's presidential campaign. In 2003, he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times pointing out that the government was, quote, cooking the books. And, you know, the fact of the matter is they were. In some ways, this began in 1961. In 61, Kennedy looked at these, at the unemployment numbers and said, you know, is there some way to make these look better? By 63, the year he was assassinated, they actually put into place this thing where they came up with this term, discouraged workers. LBJ was said to scrutinize and sometimes tweak the gross national product. But this was small stuff. Even Nixon had his own taste for statistical improvement, writes Kevin Phillips. He asked his second Federal Reserve Chairman, Arthur Burns, to develop what became ultimately famous as the division between core inflation and headline inflation. So this was Nixon who came up with the idea that rather than have an inflation rate that actually reflected the cost of living for average Americans, we should take out the really volatile things like food and transportation because they vary so much. And with housing, instead of measuring what it costs to buy a house, let's measure rents, because rents are not as affected by inflation. Rents are not as affected by housing bubbles. So let's measure rents. But in 80, Phillips writes, in 83, under the Reagan administration, statistics decided that housing, too, was overstated in the Consumer Price Index. So it substituted an entirely different owner-equivalent rent measurement. That was what I just told you about. That was in 83. That was under Reagan. Simply sidestep what was happening in the real world of homeowner costs, because low inflation encourages low interest rates, and thus we get our bubble. Hey, what a surprise. Phillips goes on to say the Reagan administration further trimmed the numbers by reclassifying members of the military as employed rather than considering them totally out of the realm of, you know, employed or unemployed, as had traditionally been the case. Then came George Herbert Walker Bush. He wanted to cut the number that, you know, what looked like inflation. So he his effort was to reduce the inflation rate in order to reduce federal payments from interest on the national debt to cost of living outlays for government employees, retirees, and Social Security. And then the Clinton administration, Kevin Phillips says, is one of the ones that implemented the actual convoluted CPI measurements that the first Bush administration came up with. So George Herbert Walker Bush proposed the changes so that people living on fixed income, Social Security, pensions, you know, whatever it may be, things like that, where the cost of living is going to affect them, that those people would get less and less money over time, even though inflation was eating away at it more and more. George Herbert Walker Bush came up with it. Bill Clinton put it into place. This was in 1996. It was promoted by, guess who? Alan Greenspan. Read Robbie Boxer's book, Greenspan's Fraud. So now you've got discouraged workers becoming a larger part of the workplace. In 94, again, in the Clinton administration, they once again redefined discouraged workers and came up with this category of long-term discouraged workers, which dropped 4 million people off the rolls, just like that. All of a sudden, it looked like employment in the United States was a whole lot better. And they also reduced their monthly household economic sample. They used to sample 60,000 people. And in 94, during the Clinton administration, they decided to drop 10,000 people from that sample, mostly people in low-income African-American neighborhoods. The result of this was that all of a sudden, during the Clinton administration, it looked like black unemployment got better, black standards of living got better, and the poor weren't as poor. Why was that? Well, it was because They went from sampling 50,000 people every year to sampling, or 60,000 to sampling 50,000. They dropped 10,000 people from the rolls, and guess who those people were? By and large, poor African Americans. So if you don't count them, they don't exist. And this is what we're left with now, is a real inflation rate of 12% right now, a real unemployment rate of 7, possibly as much as 10% right now, and real growth of less than 1%. At the same time, our businesses are being bought up by foreigners at a mind-boggling rate. We are turning into a third world country. This needs to be the issue of the election.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sitting around going, you know, it sure seems like it's a lot more expensive to live these days. And, I mean, you know, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, there were just a couple billionaires on the Forbes 400. Now they're all billionaires. In fact, being a billionaire ain't that big a deal. It seems like, you know, inflation has been huge. And yet the government says, oh, no, it hasn't been so great. And so, you know, don't worry about your Social Security check not being enough to live on anymore. This needs to be, these need to be, this stripping down of the middle class by these conservative economic policies driven by Republicans and driven by libertarians like Milton Friedman and Tom Friedman and just the whole mind-numbing, mind-boggling activities of those who would like to hand our economic fate over to transnational corporations. To hell with the national governments, you know, forget about the idea of self-governance, and basically who have come to own, lock, stock, and barrel, own the political process. We're seeing this now. John McCain has now fired 5 people from his staff because the level of corruption, because he's got some 54 more lobbyists still working for him. All these lobbyists, the level of corruption has become so obvious that it's embarrassing even somebody who's so hard to embarrass as John McCain. I mean, this is the guy who his whole political career has basically gone whichever way the lobbyists pushed him. So as Kevin Phillips writes, just to summarize this very, very tightly, he's quoting a fellow named Williams in his article, and he says, John Williams, economic statistician, he says, if you were to peel back the changes that were made in the CPI going back all the way back to the Carter years, you'd see that the CPI, this is a consumer price index, in other words, inflation, you would see that the CPI would now be 3.5 to 4% higher, meaning that because of law CPI increases, Social Security checks would be 70% greater than they currently are. And your income might be 70% greater. You wonder why it was that in my dad's generation, he was able to, working in a tool and die shop for 40 years in Lansing, Michigan, he was able to raise 4 boys, you know, put us through school to whatever extent we could or wanted to go. We had health insurance our entire lives. He did until the day he died the year before last. My mom still does. She's still getting his pension. How could he do that with one paycheck? After only 2 years of college, he dropped out of college. He wanted to be a history professor. He dropped out of college because my mom got pregnant with me and went to work in a steel mill, ended up working in a tool and die shop, metal machining company in Lansing, Michigan for 40 years. How could it be that one guy with one paycheck could have a middle-class life, bought a house in 1956 that you know, our family still has? I think he paid $13,500 for it. It's a little three-bedroom house in southern Lansing. And it was paid off when he died. His house was paid off. His car was paid off. This was the American dream. It's gone now. I'm seeing my children. I'm seeing the people of my age and the generation that's coming up behind us, and they're looking around going, you know, that what my dad did who, you know, came of age, who he was among the Japanese occupation forces right after World War II. That's gone. It's gone. And who took it? Ronald Reagan. And it wasn't just Reagan. He was the main cheerleader. He was the guy who really put into place the changes. George Herbert Walker Bush proposed a number of these changes. Bill Clinton continued the process. And Alan Greenspan was the major behind the screens player. Robbie Batra lays this out in his book, Greenspan's Fraud. And George Walker Bush, George W. Bush, big time. The stripping of the American middle class. Now, why would they do this? Why would they do that? People say, come on, what are you, some kind of conspiracy nut? Why would these guys do this? Two simple reasons. The first, and perhaps the most important, is that an economically safe, secure, and healthy middle class is, in the minds of conservatives, a dangerous thing. There have been two times in American history, the 1770s through the 1790s, and the 1960s, arguably the 1950s through the 1980s. Two times in American history where you had a large and strong, economically strong middle class. Throughout the rest of the 19th century, throughout the period in between, there was virtually no middle class outside of the family farm. You had a lot of very poor workers, and you had the robber barons, and that was it. So we had two 30-year periods in American history where you had a strong middle class. And what happened during those two periods? During those two periods, people rose up. The middle class said, enough of this. We overthrew King George. We overthrew Nixon and LBJ. We said, hell no, we won't go to the war in Vietnam. We said, you know, women wanted rights. Gays wanted rights. People of color wanted rights. And from a conservative point of view, this was a nightmare. This was social chaos. So they had to get rid of the middle class. The middle class was dangerous to the conservatives. It was politically dangerous. So instead, if you can have the disempowered working poor, you've got Thomas Frank's scenario, what's wrong, what's the matter with Kansas? Right there it is. Strip the economic power away from them, and they will not fight back. That's reason one. Reason number two, there's a side benefit to stripping all that money away from the middle class, robbing people of the equity of their homes, taking away their pensions, this benefit is that you get to give that money to the millionaires and billionaires who support the politicians doing this.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. Find out more at teamster.org. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, asking the question, how is it that my dad was able to have the American dream and people of my age are increasingly seeing it fall apart and people of my children's age are not even sure what it was? How is that possible? Kevin Phillips says, we're now experiencing the great unraveling. It's actually coming apart at the seams. They're lying to us about the numbers so that they can pretend that it's not going on, so that the right-wing bloviators can go on and say, oh, everything is fine. Look at all the new cars on the road. Everybody has a house. But not mentioning that nobody actually owns those cars except the banks. Nobody actually owns those houses, that equity is at an all-time low, that more than half of Americans have a negative net worth. As Kevin Phillips points out, public and private debt has gone from, in 1987, $11 trillion to $49 trillion last year. He says, arguably, the great unraveling has already begun. The U.S. dollar is down 40% against the euro since 2002. I mean, this is the issue. And it's done, again, as I said, because there is tremendous political benefit to wiping out the middle class. Middle classes are something. The American middle class, the first middle class, came about as a result of cheap land that could be stolen from Native Americans and slavery. And when all the land was gone, basically, and there were a lot of immigrants competing for jobs as waves of immigrants came into the United States, and most of the Indian land was stolen. Then, you know, we slid into a time when there was no middle class, basically, from the 1880s until the 1940s, and some would argue from the 1830s, there was no middle class. Excuse me. Pardon my sneeze. And then Franklin Roosevelt came along and said, no, we're going to build a middle class. We're going to build a middle class, and we're going to do it not by stealing from people, but by intervening in the so-called free market with things like supporting labor unions. The Wagner Act of 1935, legalizing unionization. I mean, we built the middle class by intervening in the marketplace, by protecting our businesses, our small businesses, with antitrust legislation. Barack Obama, by the way, recently said, and I hope that this doesn't kill his candidacy like it did Howard Dean's. Howard Dean, you'll recall, said on the Chris Matthews show he was going to break up the big media monopolies. And the next day, literally the next day, the question on the shows that were owned by NBC and all the others, for that matter, were, what's the matter with Howard Dean? Why is he so angry? All of a sudden, he was crazy. And Barack Obama said it yesterday. And, you know, what's going on? We'll see. We'll see. Anyhow, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mike in Glendale, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm a longtime listener. I really enjoy your show. I've learned so much from you. My question was, I don't know if there is a Tom Hartman crystal ball, but what I would like to know your feelings of the concept. I don't have names, but I've read over the years, the last few years, some writers and economists suggesting that the two periods that you referred to this morning, where there was a strong middle class in this country, over the long term, may turn out to be aberrations.
They have always been aberrations, Mike. They've always been aberrations. The norm for 1,000 years in Europe is what Charles Dickens wrote about in A Christmas Carol, where you've got a very, very small, very wealthy few, which was not Scrooge, by the way. He was middle class. You have a very small middle class, a small entrepreneurial, you know, the doctor and the lawyer and the small business owner. Scrooge had a small business with one employee. And then you've got a very, very large class of the working poor, and that was Bob Cratchit. You know, please, Mr. Scrooge, may I have a lump of coal? My hands are cold. No, you may not. It'll cost me a pence.
I'll take what you'll give me.
Yeah. Health care for Tiny Tim. No, we can't afford that. I mean, that's the norm. Middle classes are not normal. And when you have an absolutely laissez-faire, libertarian, unrestrained free market, you will not have a middle class. David Ricardo wrote about this in two papers that he published in 1816 and 1818, titled On Labor and On Profits. And they're both about 20 pages. They're really worth reading. And even though they're written in the style of the late, you know, 18th, early 19th century. And what he pointed out is that when the demand for labor equals the supply or exceeds, when the supply of labor equals or exceeds the demand for labor, the price of labor will go to a subsistence level, not to a middle class level, but to a subsistence. In other words, the working poor, the Bob Cratchits. And that has, you know, throughout history, that's been the case. You saw a middle class emerge in the 1400s after the Black Death in Europe. The result, and that brought about the Renaissance. And the reason that middle class emerged was because a third of Europe died off, and so there was a demand for labor that exceeded the supply of labor, which drove up the price of labor. Then you had another middle class emerge during the Enlightenment in the 1600s, which was the result of all this wealth that was coming into Europe and all the wealth that was here in North America as a result of basically stealing from indigenous people. All the hundreds of billions of dollars worth of gold that were stolen from Central and South America and taken to Spain. All of the land that the British were taking in North America and the French and the Spanish. So that produced a middle class. And then from the period from 1930 to 1980, you had, or 1940 to 1980, you had a middle class in the United States that was a result of antitrust legislation and strong unionization. Well, it was post-war, and I know that there are some conservatives who like to say that it was World War II that took us out of the Republican Great Depression, but the fact of the matter is that World War II actually slowed down our recovery from the Republican Great Depression because it depressed the rate at which we were producing domestic product.
So
we were making things
Oh, I'm sorry.
We were making things that we were dropping. We were making bombs that we dropped on Europe. So we were taking wealth, converting it into war materials, and then destroying it. Whereas if we had taken the same amount of money that we dropped into World War II on Japan and Germany, if we'd taken the same amount of wealth and instead built roads and highways and bridges and schools and hospitals, we would have been vastly wealthier, and the middle class would have come along much, much more rapidly in the 1940s and 50s.
And been more stable?
Yes, over the long term, yes.
Okay, that was my question. And what may, if in your opinion, is the firewall as a voting American citizen that we can do to maybe ensure that the what's left of the middle class remains stable and for the long term survive?
The firewalls are three. Number one, organized labor. The more, you know, keep in mind, when Reagan came into office, 25% of the American workforce was a member of a union. And for every good union job, there's an equivalent out there that you know, where companies are competing for union labor, so they offer the same benefits. So roughly half of Americans had the equivalent of a union job. Now it's down to 7% of the private
workforce.
I'm a
proud union member myself.
Good on you. Me too. So number one firewall, labor. And that's why the Employee Free Choice Act is so important, because it makes it easier for people to unionize.
Yes.
And that's why they're fighting it with these scurrilous ads that are running, you know, unionfacts.org ads and whatnot. Number two is the antitrust legislation. Break up the big corporations. This is why monopoly came along as a game in the 1920s, you know, to help people understand. It was actually a teaching game to help people understand how it was that the robber barons became the robber barons and everybody else became broke.
So the Parker brothers were...
Well, this was pre-Parker brothers. But in any case, when monopoly first came along, it was about the robber barons and you know, use the Sherman Antitrust Act, number two, and number three, tariffs. Say if you want to make a product in the United States and there's a dollar's worth of labor, say you want to make a pair of tennis shoes in the United States and there's a dollar's worth of labor in those shoes, and you want to make those, and you've decided now that you want to instead make those shoes in China where there's 20 cents worth of labor, or in Mexico where there's 40 cents worth of labor, that's fine, we're not going to stop you. But when you bring them in from China, we're going to charge you an 80 cent tariff import
mm-hmm.
tax. Or if you bring them in from Japan, from Mexico, we're going to charge you a 40 cent import tariff. So wherever you make them, your cost is going to be the same. And from 1798 until about 15 or 20 years ago, that's how it was in the United States. And that's the only reason we made shoes in the United States all that time. It's the only reason we made clothes in the United States. It's the only reason we made...
And that was Congress that enacted those.
It was Congress. It was, yes. These people were listening to the Milton Friedmans of the world and the Tom Friedmans. I got to move along, Mike, but thank you very much for the call. I mean, Tom Friedman, his book, The Olive Tree and the Lexus, really pushed this insanity and caused the Bush administration to buy into it with NAFTA and GATT. And what's so ironic is that the Lexus, in the title of Tom Friedman's book, the Lexus came about because the Lexus Loom and Mill Company, Lexus was a company that made looms for fabric. They decided to get into the car industry because the METI, the government agency, the manufacturing and trade agency in Japan, METI came along and said, we will protect the markets, we'll increase tariffs on imports if anybody wants to compete with you, we will loan you money, we'll help you develop technology. The Lexus came about as a result of government intervention, period. Ann in Walnut Creek, California, listening on Green 960. Hey, Ann.
Wow, that was really fascinating. Well, this is really interesting. I called you initially today to protest the idea of giving equal blame to the Obama and Clinton camps as far as nasty attacks are concerned, because really, obviously, it's been like 80 or 90% on the Clinton side, and I just wanted fairness. But I definitely agree with what you're saying from my own experience. I'm on Social Security, and last year was apparently the lowest cost of living increase ever. I think it was 1.99. And a few days after that was announced, it was admitted that the cost of food at that point had gone up about 50%.
Right, but they're no longer looking at it. And so spot on. Thank you for the call. And you've absolutely identified it. This is a war on the middle class done by the conservative elite. Period.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
vacation all the summer long, doing some intense relaxing just to keep our country strong. I've been seeing Condoleezza, Donald Rumsfeld too. Fox News said I'm still the greatest, so I guess it must be true. Iraq is going well, liberal doesn't sell, Bolton's in New York. I sit back and beam, Roberts is supreme, my revenge for Bork.
Yeah.
So it's been removing some brushweed.
Yeah. I will be so, let's see, what do we have here? 244 days, 12 hours, 0 minutes, 26 seconds until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office. Barring impeachment, of course. 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop by our live chat room. And also, Sean will be picking out her favorite post for the day at TomHartman.com on our show blog for the day. And that person will win a copy of my book, The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child. So if you know anybody with ADHD or have any interest in the topic, this is the most recent of the books that I've written on that topic, The Edison Gene, and we'll be giving away an autographed copy of that today to the winner of our best comment, or Sean's favorite comment, let's put it, in our blog today. Kenny in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Kenny, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom. Hey, I just got to ask you, I've been listening to you for about 4 years now, and you always talk about getting active and taking over the party and, trying to bring Democrats back to what, they're supposed to stand for, and for Republicans to do the same in their party, if I'm just hearing you correctly.
Yeah.
And it's like we did it this year. We actually, got somebody that's, trying to get away from the PAC money and the lobbyists and all that stuff. Like he said that, part of it to get passed off as ideology don't have anything to do with ideology. It just got to do with who's putting money in these people's pockets.
Sure.
And then you come back and
you're talking about Barack Obama.
Yeah, that's what he said. He said conservative ideology don't have anything to do with against, lower prescription for seniors and stuff.
Yeah, no, he's telling it like it is.
Right.
So your
my
point.
Thing is, then you say, well, we need to put Hillary on a ticket with Barack, and it just doesn't mash. She's taking lobbyist money and. At the end of the day, I hear she quoting Karl Rove now.
Yeah, I know. I thought that was pretty tragic. Kenny, my point was that if Barack Obama is the nominee, that he should ask her first, because there's a lot of supporters for her out there among the Democrats. But I think to your point, Arianna Huffington wrote a great blog over at Huffington Post yesterday, in which she pointed out that Hillary Clinton has left Bill in the dust, that she's taking positions that are far more populist. She's rejecting his internationalism. She's rejecting his embrace of the big bankers. She's rejecting his free trade deal stuff and GATT and NAFTA and things like that. And so, frankly, I think that Hillary Clinton is a whole lot more progressive than Bill Clinton. I think Bill Clinton was basically to the right of Dwight Eisenhower in many ways. And so, I'm not quite so concerned about that. Let's see, Jack in Seattle. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I really enjoy your program. I was really hoping that there would be more exposure about the defense contractors, the war contractors, and the people that are really making money off of the war in Iraq. It sickens me a lot.
Yeah, I riffed on that at some length, Jack, yesterday on the program, and this article that was in the Wall Street Journal on the Saturday edition, I encourage you to go back and look at it, how Booz Allen is making $3.5 billion in government contracts through the military. And this is money that could be being done by government employees, but instead it's being done by private corporations who are paying their employees far more than government employees make. And their CEOs are making a pile of money, and they're skimming percentage off the top for dividends, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's just so wrong. It's just so wrong. Rob in Long Island. Hey, Rob, Long Island, New York.
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I once again want to thank you for being the educator in the world full of people who are just running their mouth.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk to you real quickly about. I was discussing with a conservative I guess if you want to call it debate, having a conservative debate with a conservative. And I mentioned what I just read your book, Screwed. So, of course, one of the few things that I mentioned him was the fact that it was Ronald Reagan who had been taking from the Social Security Trust Fund for years to prop up his failed economics.
Right.
And he made the argument that the only reason Reagan was allowed to do that was because LBJ had removed the firewall that didn't allow the government to touch that trust fund. And I didn't have a response for that. So I'm coming to you because you wrote the story. You know more about it than I do. So I'm looking for inspiration here.
Well, actually, there was no Social Security Trust Fund during LBJ's administration, at least what I was talking about in the book and what Robbie Batra talks about. What the Greenspan-Moynihan Commission came up with in 1982, I believe it was, or maybe it was 83, was they said there's this python coming through, this rabbit coming through the python. You know, there's this big bulge that's coming down through the snake here of time, and that big bulge is the baby boomer generation. And right now at 6% taxes for Social Security on people making less than $35,000 a year, there's not going to be enough money. This was in 83. It's not going to be enough money to pay for the boomers to retire. At that point in time, all the money that was paid out by Social Security to retired persons was being paid in by working people. In other words, the people who were working in 83 were supporting the generation that had retired. So what they did is they doubled down. They said, okay, we're going to have for the next 40 years, we're going to have people, the boomers basically, not only pay for the retirement of their parents, but we're going to double that tax. This was the largest tax increase in the history of the United States that Reagan pushed through. We're going to double that tax, and half of that money is going to be set aside so that the boomers not only are going to pay for their parents' retirement, but they're also going to pay for their own retirement. And then in 2030, 2040, when the boomers are pretty much all dead, we'll go back to a pay-as-you-go system, and presumably the tax can go back down. So, you know, LBJ may have jiggered the laws. Frankly, I don't know the details of that. It wouldn't surprise me. You know, they were having a terrible time paying for the war in Vietnam. But it's a whole completely different order of magnitude from what Reagan did. And Reagan did that, and he created that Social Security Trust Fund, and within a year, Reaganomics was in the tank so badly that he had to start raiding it, and they've been raiding it ever since.
The Tom Hartman Program, the true people's radio.
Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Oregon, by the way, the place from which we broadcast, broadcasting here from the banks of the steadily rising Willamette River, where, oh, by the way, the other day I mentioned our Gusolini, our crazed goose, who has five babies, and how Gusolini was basically going, it seemed like Gusolini had snatched a bunch of baby geese, and it turns out, I've gotten a bunch of emails from folks saying, no, wild geese actually babysit. And it's amazing. Sometimes we see Gusolini with 14 babies, and sometimes we see him and his partner, and sometimes we see him and his partner with only their four chicks, or five goslings. And Adam and Steve are back. We have a gay duck couple that for 3 years have been living on near our back deck, and they've been back for a week or so, and yesterday they were around and hanging out and having a good old time. So anyhow, that's the wildlife update, but the river is really going up fast. But the point of it all is that I live here in Portland, Oregon, and Oregon is one of the most normal states in America. It's one of the most average states in America. In other words, we have the right, we have the left, we have the rich, the poor. A lot of companies test products out in Oregon. A lot of politicians, there's a lot of political testing going on in Oregon. And Oregon is, I think, going to, well, let's get a real Oregon opinion here. I've only lived here 3 years. Hank Stern is with us. Hank is the managing news editor with Willamette Week, which is our weekly paper here in Oregon. W Week, we refer to it as Willie Week. WWeek.com is their website. Hey, Hank, welcome to the show.
How are you doing?
Just great, and thanks for being with us. This whole issue of I'm assuming that you've seen the recent news stories about how Oregon is the most polarized of the states, and yet it's the most normal of the states. We have the Kerry The folks who voted for Kerry were more liberal than in Oregon than pretty much anywhere else in the United States, and the folks who voted for Bush were more conservative than pretty much anywhere else in the United States. Your thoughts on that?
To know Oregon, you sort of have to divide it up geographically as you do a bunch of different states. But between Portland and Eugene, which is about a 100-mile corridor, is known as the Willamette Valley, and it is a very liberal place. You've got the University of Oregon in Eugene. You've got Oregon State University in Corvallis, Salem, which is the state capital, and then Portland, which is a very liberal place. But then you get outside of the Willamette Valley, and it can get very conservative very quickly. And if somebody from Portland were to talk with somebody from John Day in Eastern Oregon, it can be fairly polarizing.
But even here within Portland, what they found was that the liberals were more liberal and the conservatives were more conservative. And my theory on this, and I'd like to bounce this off you, My theory on this is that because we're a place where it's cheap to test things, we know that out-of-state money, Mr. Rich's money, and who's the medical the sexual hypnotist in Las Vegas?
Lauren Parks.
He throws money into this state. And they do these because we're a state where you can put something on the ballot initiatives, these various measures. They will take the wild right-wing fringe ballot measures and throw them on the ballot in the state because they can do it for a couple $100,000, whereas if they wanted to do it in California, it would cost millions. And if it works, if they have success, then they roll them out into 20 or 30 other states. If they don't have success with it, they say, okay, we learned from that. Let's try a different way. And because we've been the victims of, Oregon has been the victims of these kinds of highly polarizing, highly partisan, heavily emotionally charged, you know, girls cannot get abortions even in case of rape or incest, blah, blah, if they're under 15 years old, you know, stuff like that. I mean, throwing these kind of things on the ballots, The result of this has been the extreme polarizing of the electorate of the state, in my opinion.
Well, I think there probably is a connect there between the ease with which folks can get stuff on the ballot here and then the polarization that those issues generate. I would only say that the flip side of that, at least a positive, is you also have a lot of things that have been passed here, medical marijuana, assisted suicide,
where the legislature was too timid to take them up.
Right.
And so we the people
it does
did.
Become sort of a proving ground. You're right, and it does lend to polarization. But
right.
As somebody who's lived here for a while, people are impassioned in their beliefs, but for the most part, fairly reasonable. Now, whether or not that's a West Coast thing, I'll leave it to others to decide.
So how do you think this is going to play out? Here we've got these two states, Kentucky and Oregon, holding their primaries today. And Barack Obama showed up here on what was it, Friday? I was in Chicago when he showed up. Saturday, I guess it was.
And then Sunday was the big
Sunday,
rally.
Sunday was the big rally, I'm sorry. 75,000 people. I mean, it's mind-boggling just even to think of it. How do you think that this is going to play out in Oregon?
In tonight, with the results?
Yeah.
There's a cautionary note, even the size of that rally. I mean, I don't remember the numbers, but people were pointing to the huge rallies Walter Mondale had at the end in October of 84, and we know how that turned out. In this case, I think it's a little different because it is a primary, and there is genuine enthusiasm for here that I think is translating into a strong vote for him today. He'll win comfortably, but it's more than just the rally. I mean, you look at their organizing efforts and the number of offices they have in really remote corners of Oregon. To think that a presidential campaign would be organized in some of these cities, I think it all adds up to a pretty convincing win for him tonight.
Well, the flip side of that, though, is I was over in Coos County, which, for people who are not from Oregon, this is over on the seacoast, and it's down south toward the California border, and it's like basically not close to any kind of metro area. I mean, it was a five-hour drive from Portland. I spoke, this was two weekends ago, spoke at a fundraiser for the Democratic Party there. And, in fact, Steve Novick showed up. He was, a couple of candidates showed up. Steve, and I want to talk to you about Steve in just a second, and gave his talk. But Hillary Clinton had been there, or Bill Clinton had been there, like the week earlier. And everybody was like, you know, people in towns of 2,000 and 3,000 people, they were just all agog that Hillary Clinton had bothered to show up. I mean, she was – so you have Obama with this incredible – structure, you know, this organization. And yet you also have the Clintons hitting small towns that Barack Obama doesn't go to. Which is going to win?
I think the Obama approach will win, but here's what I'd look for if you're looking at those counties tonight. While, you know, the Clintons, Hillary, Bill, Chelsea, spread themselves out throughout Oregon and those places, I do believe that the on-the-ground organization is still superior for the Obama people. Part of that's because of their fundraising, but a large part of it is just that they have organized better. And I think while, you know, Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton can draw decent-sized crowds to town halls in those small towns, I mean, some of that, I suspect, and it's only a suspicion, is that these small towns don't get visits from Bill or Hillary Clinton very often, and it's sort of the novelty of it. We'll see how it actually plays out.
Now, showing how
there's not a lot of votes there either.
Yeah. Showing how kind of middle of the road state we are. We have two senators here in Oregon, Gordon Smith, who is a Republican who votes almost 100% of the time, over 90% of the time, solidly with George W. Bush, except for the year before the election. This is his second election, and in the year before the election, all of a sudden Gordon Smith becomes a moderate, and sort of like Norm Coleman in Minnesota, and a few others, and Ron Wyden. Ron Wyden, a Democrat. So we have a Democratic senator and a Republican senator. Ron Wyden is not up for re-election in this cycle, but Gordon Smith is, and all of a sudden he's making all these moderate noises, and he criticized Bush on the war and all that kind of thing. We have two Democrats. We have a number of Democrats, but two big Democrats, Steve Novick and Jeff Merkley, who are challenging him. And that race is becoming – there's a lot of interest in that race. We've got about three-quarters of a minute here. We're talking with Hank Stern, WWeek.com. How do you think that's going to shake out, and what's it going to mean for the general election?
Well, I think the number of new voters that Obama has brought in terms of new registrations helps Steve Novick, who, quick thumbnail description, is a very unconventional candidate. He is disabled with a left hook that he for a hand that he plays upon in his campaign ads, whereas Jeff Merkley is a House Speaker, has sort of risen through the ranks in the state legislature.
Well, and Steve Novick is also an old-time Nader hardcore progressive. I mean, a very serious progressive,
right.
and an activist.
And I think the nearest comparison in the Senate would have been Paul Wellstone for him.
Yeah.
And I think he's got a pretty good chance tonight.
That's interesting. Well, I voted for Novick, so we'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens.
Indeed. All righty. Hank Stern, the managing news editor over at Willie Week, Willamette Week, WWeek.com is the website. If you're interested in Oregon politics and you want to see how it's playing out in this state, you can check it out. Hank, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program here on Air America Radio. And Starbucks has a new old logo. They've gone back to their original logo, and it has upset some folks. We have with us Mark Dice. He is the founder of the Christian group The Resistance, their website, TheResistanceManifesto.com. Now, the Resistance has taken on other celebrities, Jessica Simpson, Paris Hilton, 50 Cent, Tom Cruise, even demanded that Duke University change the name of their Blue Devils sports team to something that's not offensive to Christians, and or at least to this particular Christian. Mark, welcome to the program.
You know, thanks for having me, and I don't know how many Air America supporters are going to be on board with the boycott, but I just want to thank you for having me on and continuing the media coverage of the Slut Bucks. New logo.
Yeah, I know that that's what you're calling it, and I'm a little baffled. And first of all, let me say that as a Christian myself, I'm not offended by the Blue Devils at Duke University or by this mermaid on Starbucks. I think that we have much bigger issues. I mean, I go back to Matthew 24. Shouldn't we be concerning ourselves with issues of poverty and disease and people in prison, the stuff that Jesus told us to pay attention to?
Sure, but you know, that's an interesting point, and the mainstream media doesn't want to cover issues like that, issues like the Bohemian Grove, the Bilderberg Group. But you know, you mentioned something about the Starbucks logo being inappropriate, and everybody covers it. And so I hope everybody that comes to MarkDice.com can see that we do cover those issues. This is just a side note. This is something we essentially fed to the media to get them riled up so that we can bring attention to these more important issues. And one note on the Blue Devils sports team. You know, you say that maybe that doesn't offend some Christians, but I'm sure that most of the Jewish listeners out there, the Jewish population, would be quite offended if sports teams were to be called the Nazis or the Hitlers. And on the same token, Christian organizations such as ourselves, and I'm sure many others, are offended when the term of the devil or Satan is used as a positive role model and as an icon for a sports team.
Well, I think it's an imperfect analogy, but you know, we can agree to disagree. The Starbucks logo. This originally was a siren from Greek mythology, the twin-tailed siren. It's been streamlined over the years.
Yeah.
The actual original was a 15th century European woodcut. I mean, they actually used a 500-year-old woodcut, a double fishtail. And you say that because this siren, that her breasts are covered by her hair and that she's holding these twin fishtails, that this is like she's spreading her legs and oh my God, her boobs are showing, right?
Yeah, her figurative legs are spread eagle open like a prostitute. The Greek sirens, while in mythology, were known to be beautiful and lure sailors in, you know, according to these writings in the Iliad and so forth, and then they would kill these soldiers once they came in. So it's indisputable that it's a sexual position, that she's got her twin tails spread eagle, and she is topless.
But
also,
this is nothing compared to what you'll find in any magazine or any Sunday newspaper just advertising the clothes at the local department store.
Now, I think seeing a beautiful woman in a nice dress or a fancy top is a little bit different than having her.
Or a lingerie or swimsuits or the come hither looks that are explicitly sexual. I mean, this is not explicitly sexual. This is 15th century. You have to know the history of the mythology to know that there might even be any kind of sexuality to this.
I think that her sitting spread eagle topless is quite suggestive, actually.
So, alrighty. Well, Mark, we're talking with Mark Dice, markdice.com, theresistancemanifesto.com. Mark, you say that you're going after Starbucks to try and get attention so that you can bring attention to real issues like following the suggestions of Christ to end poverty, to care for the homeless, to care for the ill, for the sick, to visit those in prison. What are you doing in those regards? What are you doing, for example, to end poverty in America?
Well, we have produced a film actually titled A Homeless Christmas, which you can find on Google Video. And we pick up a homeless individual off of the street, and we help interview him. We take him around, show him the love that Christ would show, trying to encourage everybody to not forget about the homeless. We do a lot of work.
But isn't there a difference between evangelizing people and actually helping them get out of their economic straits? I mean, Jesus didn't just go up to people and say, hey, become a Christian. In fact, there was no Christianity at the time. He healed them. He said, you know, I'm going to take care of you.
Well, I think we've all lost a little bit of the faith since then, and we don't have quite the power that Christ would want us to have. But yeah, I mean,
we have plenty of medications that can heal people. We have the means to reduce poverty. We've done it before in this country. It's being done in countries all over the world. It's just that, you know, conservatives say, oh my God, that's socialism, what they're doing in Sweden. How can you have a country without poverty?
Look, I try to bring both parties together. I think there's a core center where we actually agree on a variety of issues. Of course, we have our extremes, and each party has particular issues that kind of defines the party. But I'm trying to unify the people into a main cause here to really stand up for America, for our freedoms, stand up for what's right. Let's not have, you know, one out of three or four students now in college has an STD. We really need to analyze what it is we're doing and our behaviors.
Mark, we've got to wrap it up, but you've said it well. MarkDice.com, the website, or TheResistanceManifesto.com. Thanks, Mark, for dropping by.
You got it.
27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
34 minutes past the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, our website. Sean looking over our comments for the day to come up with her favorite comment in today's blog at TomHartman.com for a free copy of The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child, signed by me. And strange things going on in Italy. Has to do, of course, with Silvio Berlusconi. What happens when a small-time crook, an entrepreneur, or small-time businessman buys a radio station, and then a television station, and then another radio station, and then a newspaper, and then another radio station, and then buys a radio network, and then buys a TV network, and then buys another radio network, and then another TV network, and then the last TV station, and then another newspaper, and pretty soon owns 90% of the media in the entire country, and then runs for prime minister? Guess what? He wins! And he won again. Well, this is a little interesting twist on all this. Poor Mr. Berlusconi now may be called to testify in court. Apparently, when he was prime minister before, there was a brief moment in time where he was not prime minister, and he is now again. U.S. agents and military personnel are going to be tried in absentia because George Bush won't send them over there in Italy for the crime of kidnapping people and taking them out of country and torturing them. The person in this case is a fellow by the name of Mr. Nasser, who says he was tortured for 4 years in Cairo. And and Judge Oscar Maggi ruled that the former prime minister, Romano Prodi, as well as Silvio Berlusconi, may have to testify. Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi will be called as a witness in a trial over the alleged CIA kidnapping of a terrorist suspect. Isn't it terrible that America is being dragged through the mud like this? Our CIA agents are being prosecuted in a court of law in Italy. And the prime minister, Silvio Berlusconi, is going to have to testify. 26 Americans and 6 Italians are accused of kidnapping a Muslim cleric from Italy and sending him to Egypt where he was tortured, or where he claims he was tortured. Berlusconi doesn't face any charges in the trial, but he, in all probability, will have to testify. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Laura in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hey, Laura, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to make a comment about your conversation before the break with Mark Dice.
Yeah.
And I wanted to thank you for having my back as a Christian, that the idea that we're called for justice and mercy and iconic mermaids aren't really the deal.
Yeah, I don't remember Jesus railing about public nudity. I really and truly have read the Bible 4 times from Genesis to Revelation.
And there are a lot of fishermen, and I don't ever remember mermaids being in
there. Yeah, there you go.
So I just wanted to thank you, and to thank you for not allowing the Christian perspective to be so narrowly defined.
Thank you. I call them the so-called Christians. But thank you, Laura. Thank you for your kind words, and I appreciate the call. Brandon in Newport Beach, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Brandon.
Hey, Tom. Thank you. You know, I just wanted to say that in Huntington Beach, our neighboring city, there is a statue of a her, and the surfer is naked, and this apparently caused huge controversy among some of the Christian right there in that town who wanted to put some boxer shorts on the statue. And I think it runs across the same line that, you know, by attempting to hide people from the fact that, you know, there are genitalia about and that, you know, everybody has body parts, we're really creating unnecessary deviance. It's Larry Craig situation. We wind up, you know, hiding something and it comes out in the form of rape.
Oh, what's forbidden becomes fascination. And there are, and we've done entire shows on this. There are statistics that show in those countries where pornography is widely available and or where prostitution is legal, the rates of rape are much lower than in those countries where pornography is strongly forbidden and where prostitution is prosecuted. I don't think anybody wants to be, you know, a wild and enthusiastic advocate of either, but there's the numbers and you can't fight them. And, you know, we're mammals too. I mean, you know, the people are people. But the thing that really baffles me is the confluence of religion and prudishness. I think that this is something that's largely unique to America and England and Ireland, to the former United Kingdom colonies. I mean, I lived in Germany for a year and a half. I remember when the guy came out to our house. We lived in this little town out in the middle of nowhere, Stadtsteinach in the Frankenwald. And a guy came out to install a washing machine. And Louise walks into the living room and gasped as she looks through the picture window. Here's this guy in our front lawn taking a whiz on the front lawn, right? And he comes back into the house and she says, you know, why didn't you use the bathroom? And he said, oh, I didn't want to dirty up your bathroom. Then we're driving down the street and here's this entire busload of tourists. And there's like 30 guys in a row. The bus is pulled off to the side rest area. 30 guys standing outside the bus all whizzing in the grass. It was not at all uncommon to see, you know, naked kids in the swimming pools, topless people. I mean, you know, continental Europe doesn't give a damn. But somehow, and I think it's Queen Victoria, I think that she was, I don't know if she was, you know, molested as a kid or if she, you know, what happened, but she was crazed about sexuality. And as a consequence of that, for 200 years, America and England and Ireland have been stuck with this. And I don't understand why it gets associated with religion. I don't get it. Brandon?
Oh, Brandon. Yeah, I agree. You know?
Any theories?
I think it's the taboo situation. It being conflated with religion is, I think, you know, it goes back to the Inquisition, frankly.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you end up with the same situation with marijuana or with drinking age being high and causing high levels of alcoholism. I mean, you know, maybe it's just
that those folks who believe in original sin, who think that humans are fundamentally evil and that we have to have an iron fist of some sort, whether it's a church or a state, to restrain us from our own impulses, tend to be the ones who are the most afraid of things like sexuality or about their, you know, about their own humanness, frankly, humanity. Nora in L.A., listening on K-Talk. Hey, Nora.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Just fine, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, first of all, thank you. You're probably, in my opinion, one of the most intelligent people that I listen to on the radio, if not the most intelligent. That last fellow that you had that you interviewed, you know, in my opinion, he is completely misguided. I really think he's clueless, and I think part of that has to do with the fact that a lot of Christians today subscribe to the New Testament, which if they did their homework and really went back and studied and read about what the historians and scholars have discovered, the New Testament is pretty much a myth, and it was fabricated during the Council of Nicaea to dismiss the impact and the power of women in the church. So he is totally clueless, and nothing he said has had any social redeeming value. In fact, even when you question him about, well, what are you doing to further Jesus Christ's message, he basically had nothing to say other than, you know, to stand on a soapbox and waste people's time about something that is just so meaningless with all the problems and issues that we're facing today in our society. I can't believe that people are actually wasting their time with this.
Well, maybe it's time for us to all go out and buy Starbucks. And say, Nora, thanks for the call. And say, yeah, we're, you know, we'll go along with that. Tim in L.A. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Tom, hope you're feeling a lot better.
I am. I'm feeling great. Thank you.
Oh, great. You know what? I think that Mark isn't your typical right-wing Christian, you know, evangelist, but more of this new breed, conservative, new world order fighter, warrior, because he brought up the Bilderberg.
Right.
And I think that Starbucks...
Which is very often, by the way, code for anti-Semitism. You know, I'm familiar with this community, and it's like, you know, it's... I remember when Pat Buchanan was running for president, and he came to Atlanta and gave his speech, and he talked about the Bilderbergers, and he talked about those people who control the world's economy. And it was code for, you know, those Jews who control the world's economy, and as if, you know... I'm sure there's a lot of Jewish people sitting around going, hey, I'd like a piece of that, but no. So when people, more often than not, when people go into those kind of rants, it's code for anti-Semitism is what it is.
Maybe it is. I don't know about him, but, you know, a lot of times those folks are saying, like, you know, they'll bring up something like, you know, the Starbucks thing, you know, the mermaid. It's bad, it's evil. It isn't, I guess, the mermaid itself, but the symbol that it represents, and it's, I guess, this probably supposed to represent the new world order or the evils that the right and the left elites, you know, promote to, you know, to create a one world government. And that's my take on it.
Well, that's, you know, that's a legitimate concern that there not be individual nations. And if you really have that concern, rather than going off on Starbucks having a two-tailed mermaid, or rather than going off, frankly, on the United Nations, which is relatively powerless and is mostly there to promote world peace, how about going after the World Trade Organization? I mean, there is where the money is. There is where the power is. I mean, this is the stuff that John Perkins talks about in his books, you know, Confession of an Economic Hitman. It's the World Trade Organization, the WTO. It's the whole NAFTA. It's the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades. If you want a conspiracy, I guess by definition isn't a conspiracy because it's not secret. I mean, they do it all right out in the open, but it's all right there. You know, it's like screw the middle class in every country around the world, impose what they call economic austerity measures. And it is the most anti-religious message in the world, in my opinion, and destructive.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, and we caught somebody doing something right. Yes, indeed. Fried shrimp on a bit of jasmine rice to a side of mango salad, all served on a styrofoam plate. No, ain't going to show up at the Democratic Convention, according to Douglas Brown, writing in the Denver Post. Instead, the Democratic Party has said no fried foods. Fried foods are forbidden at the committee's 22 or so events. Plates must be reusable, and food should be local, organic, or both. Cool. This is great. The Democratic Party is being food socially conscious. Fine thing. Brian in Sonoma County, you wanna challenge me on my comment about the Bilderbergers?
I've read a lot of these websites that have Bilderberg information, and they all get pinged by the people like antis against them.
Right.
Saying that they're anti-Semites, and that's the farthest thing from the truth. The majority of these websites are trying to expose, like, the bad things going on, like, with Hezbollah between, like, the Palestinians and Israel, and saying how, like, the companies and stuff are profiting from all that. So,
you know, Brian, if your point is that the Bilderberger group is not a Jewish group and therefore it's silly to call people who are constantly pointing at them anti-Semitic, that point at least at the level of theory makes a certain amount of sense. But the fact of the matter is that my experience, just, you know, having done talk radio for 6 years and having lived in this country for over 50, is that 90% of the time when somebody goes off on a Bilderberger rant, If you scratch deep enough, what you're going to find underneath there is some paranoid fantasy that the Jews secretly control the world for their own ends, and that it is anti-Semitic. And I'm just, you know, it's there, and I'm telling you.
I've seen plenty of that online.
Oh, okay, so then you're agreeing with me. So I mean, anybody with Google can check it out. It's just enough. Point made. Thank you. Ken in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, listening on Winds. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Hey, how's it going?
Just great. What's up?
I'm just wondering why nobody is talking about Iran and Bush setting up to invade Iran.
I think it's just self-evident.
Isn't it the scariest thing that's going on? He invades Iran. He then says... he's going to call off the elections because we're at war.
No, I don't think that's how it's going to play out. Here's how I think it's going to play out, Ken. My guess is you'll remember that that Syria was recently attacked. A nuclear facility was taken out. I believe it was the Israelis who did it. I don't think that we did it. And there was basically, you know, no response. My guess is that there are two constituencies that McCain needs to turn out in the general election that he doesn't have. Actually, one large constituency. And that's the constituency of fundamentalist, hardcore, right-wing, John Hagee, conservative Christians who believe that it is absolutely necessary for there to be a war on the plain of Armageddon north of Jerusalem in order to bring Jesus back to the world. And that in that war, all but 144,000 Jews are going to die, and those 144,000 are going to be converted to Christianity. I mean, there's this very well-formed Christian theology around this. Hal Lindsey first wrote about it in 1973 in his book, The Late Great Planet Earth. Going Home series or whatever it is. There's this series of books that are the biggest selling fiction in the history of the planet right now. Left Behind series are out there. And the Republicans have to figure out a way to get those hardcore, they want there to be war in the Middle East and because they think it's going to bring back Jesus. And there's even a small contingent, actually, of Jews in Israel. I know a few of them who are driving around with bumper stickers that say Mashiach now, and they won't speak Hebrew and they don't recognize a Jewish state because they say it's not headed up by Messiah. And in some cases, they're forming alliances with these crazed Christians. And so there's like this kind of war bunch. And so my take is that if Bush were to pinprick bomb Iran in a way that, you know, just take out some of the places where they're enriching uranium or whatever, you know, not kill a whole lot of people, not do an enormous amount of damage, enough to be able to say that he did it, enough to stir up world outrage, but not enough to actually start a war, that will cause, and then McCain was to salute that flag, that would cause that hard right part of the Christian of the fringe of the WASP Christians in the United States, who otherwise are probably going to stay home and not vote for McCain because he has in the past supported things like abortion rights, that will cause them to come out in the general election. I think that this is all about election strategy.
So I think you're wrong. I think it's all about war crimes. These guys who are in power right now are facing war crimes. If Obama gets elected, he has already said he's going to go after them. The only way they can avoid getting, you know, war crimes thrown at them is if McCain gets elected, and if they think he's not going to be electable, they got to do something else. The other thing is start the war, declare martial law, and no elections.
But see, I don't think that Americans would stand for suspending the elections in a declaration of martial law. I don't think that they, in fact, there's so much, you know, you've got Condi Rice and Gates, the Secretary of Defense, in the administration right now, arguing against even the small attacks on Iran.
Condi Rice is one of the people that might be facing the war crimes after that meeting they all had.
Then why is she opposed to attacking Iran?
With the torture.
Right, I understand that, but why then is she opposed to attacking Iran?
Is she?
She is. This is according to all the reports I'm reading. Ellen Ratner is going to be with us the next hour. We'll talk with her about it. But
yeah,
she,
I'd love to hear that.
She knows, you know, folks who knows folks, as they say.
I travel all over the world. My company, we just travel all over the world. And people are other countries are worried about this.
Yeah, no, and Ellen has an apartment in Dubai and spends part of the year there, and she's, you know, in Dubai, they're very worried about it, too. Ken, thanks for the call. Oddly, we agree that Bush is probably going to attack Iran before he's out of office. I think so, too. I'll play the clip about why he attacked Iraq and about why I think that's why he's going to attack Iran after this break.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program. Jeff Charlotte. By the way, the clip I mentioned about Bush in Iraq, I want to get to that a little later on in the program, perhaps the bottom of this hour, about 25 minutes from now. So stick around for that. Why Bush invaded Iraq, why he may invade Iran. I think the reasons are the same, but we'll get to that. The discussion that we had in the last hour with our fundamentalist friend who was saying that the new Starbucks logo is an abomination and Christians should be righteously indignant. That's the public face of the hard right of Christianity. There is a private face to it. And in the opinion of some, a far more dangerous face. If you consider the ideals of, for example, Lenin and Mao and Stalin and Pol Pot to be dangerous. The leader of this group, Brother Ko, the first brother, the stealth persuader, he said, you say, hey, you know, Jesus said, you got to put him, Jesus, before your mother and your father and your brother and your sister. Hitler, Lenin, Mao, that's what they taught the kids. Mao even had the kids killing their own mother and father. But it wasn't murder. It was for building a new nation, the new kingdom. End of quote. That from a leader of an organization based out of Washington, D.C., I believe, called The Family. And Jeff Charlotte has written the book, The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. At the Heart of American Power. Doug, or Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. This is a very disturbing book. What's perhaps most disturbing about it is that this so-called Christian cult is made up principally of some of the most powerful and famous people, including politicians, in American life.
Yeah, the family's fundamental belief is, you said so-called Christian cult, and that's exactly right. They're almost anti-Christian in a way because they think Christianity got it wrong for 2,000 years by, you know, focusing on the poor, the weak, the down and out. And the original insight with which they started the group was that from their perspective, God cares more about what they call the up and out, those who are already in powerful. And so they have always focused on ministering only to the elite. Today, their membership includes men like Senator Sam Brownback, Representative Joe Pitt, Senator John Ensign, Senator Jim Inhofe, Senator Chuck Grassley has been very involved, Representative Frank Wolf. This long list, if you look at their historic roll call, it's almost even more frightening. Strom Thurmond, Herman Talmadge, the famous Dixiecrat, and a man named Absalom Willis Robertson, senator from Virginia and father of Pat Robertson, was once their vice president. Hmm. So that's who they focus on. The elite.
And our former secretary of state, what was John Ashcroft?
Oh, John Ashcroft, John, yeah. Former Attorney General John
Attorney
Ashcroft,
General,
as well
yeah.
as former Attorney General Ed Meese, yeah. is very involved. Ashcroft, back in the 80s, I found in their archives, letters from a young politician named John Ashcroft from Missouri, kind of a nobody,
yeah.
writing to Doug Coe, the head, and says, you know, I want to get involved in government, and I think I can carry, you know, Christ's message into government. Can you help me? And, of course,
wow.
Coe did.
Now, you infiltrated this group. You did it right up front. You told them that you were a writer. You didn't tell them that you were going to write an expose book on them. Actually, one of them suggested that to you at a certain point and said nobody would believe it. But, you know, you went inside this group and lived with them, hung out with them. How did that come about?
Well, I've been writing about religion for magazines and, you know, newspapers and so on for years. And it was several years ago, a friend of mine was concerned that her brother had gotten involved in a cult. And since she knew I knew a lot about these kinds of groups, she asked if I would meet with him. So I met the guy. I'd known the guy for years. And he said, you should really check this out. And you only get in by invitation. And they're also only interested in elites, as I said. So they were actually interested in the fact that I was a journalist, an influencer from their perspective.
Right.
And they allowed me to come live with them for a month. And, you know, frankly, when I got involved, I didn't know it was a political movement. I hadn't been told that. I thought this was just a sort of interesting little subculture. But within the first few days of my visit there, we had a visit from Jesse Helms, Senator Jesse Helms. That showed their access to power. And then, very odd, the Prime Minister of Norway, it's almost like a Monty Python joke.
He's the new Prime Minister of Norway is a conservative.
Well, this was actually the Prime Minister at that point was, a social conservative guy named Bondevik. And in fact, his involvement with the family became a big story there. It was sort of a Norwegian Watergate. But what it really revealed to me was that this wasn't a Christian right group the way that I think a lot of progressives think about. And one of the arguments I make in the family is that we kind of need a paradigm shift. We need to recognize that there's that populist front represented by guys like James Dobson and the late Jerry Falwell, but there's also this elite movement. And while the popular Christian right rises and falls, and it's kind of falling right now, this elite movement dates back 70 years, and it endures, and it's something we're going to have to reckon with no matter who is in the Oval Office.
Yeah, it's sort of like the Fed and our money supply. Exactly. The Revealer.com, by the way.
.org, sorry.
.org, thank you. The Revealer.org is your website. We're talking with Jeff Charlotte, who is the author of The Family. And Hillary Clinton is not a... Now, I've gotten all these emails from people over the last few months, you know, you want to talk about Obama's pastor, you should know about Hillary Clinton's pastor. And apparently there was an article outing the family and her association with them in one of the mainstream magazines. I don't know if it's Harper's or Atlantic or something like that.
My colleague Catherine Joyce and I wrote about this, and Mother Jones, and then
Mother
Barbara
Jones.
Ehrenreich, who gave me a terrific blurb for the book.
Front cover.
Just decided to put it out there in the nation as well, and so it sort of got around.
Right, but
and,
the fact of the matter is that she's not actually a member. She's sort of a friend of the family, as are many politicians.
Exactly, exactly. And a friend is a formal designation to them. She writes in her memoir, Living History, you know, this is not our charge, by the way. She writes about this. In 1993, she comes to Washington. Doug Coe, the head of the family, organizes a prayer group for her that's made up of very powerful conservative women, Susan Baker, wife of James Baker, Joanne Kemp, wife of Jack Kemp. And she refers to Doug Coe, this man whom you quoted at the beginning as looking to Hitler, Lenin, and Mao for leadership lessons, as a genuinely loving spiritual mentor and guide. Now, does that mean she shares all his views? No. What it means is that this group has recognized that instead of banging on the outside, like the popular Christian right, they're going to work from the inside.
Right.
As Doug Coe, the leader, says, we work with power where we can, build new power where we can't. So they're very interested in access to whoever's powerful. And if Hillary's powerful, they want to know her, even if they don't agree with her.
In the last segment, somebody called in and started going off about Bilderbergers, and I made the comment that 9 times out of 10 when somebody starts talking about the Bilderberger group or et cetera, that it's code for anti-Semitism.
Exactly.
And there's, this, the probably the most common of the anti-Semitic perspectives is that the Jews control the world through some secret mechanism. But it sounds to me like what you're describing is a fundamentalist, Protestant, Christian group that is taking control of the United States, of the levers of power within the United States. To what extent are they actually in charge? What is the depth and the breadth, the reach of their power? To what extent could they actually change or affect policy if they choose to or have chosen to?
Well, I think one thing to emphasize, and you raised that crazy Bilderberger stuff, and I think it's really important. The left has got to stop getting distracted by conspiracy theories. We're always looking for the conspiracy theory that'll explain it all. And the thing with a family is they're not a conspiracy. They don't break laws. They make laws, and they're entitled to do that. They're
doing it right out in the open. It's not like they're
exactly.
They've got a secret handshake.
Well, they're not quite on the open, but they don't have to announce what they're doing. They can do these things privately. And so what they can do, for instance, they refer to the prayer cells that they create. This is their document. You can find, by the way, all their documents at the Billy Graham Center Archives in Wheaton, Illinois. So anyone who wants to check up on me and see if this is real can check it out. They refer to themselves as invisible believing groups. So say Sam Brownback and Representative Joe Pitts get together in an invisible believing group, and they talk about what Jesus wants for the world. And they're really mainly interested in foreign affairs. And then they come out of that, as Brownback and Pitts did, and teamed up on something called the Silk Road Act, which funnels U.S. aid to some really brutal regimes in the Central Asian region, and happens to be, in fact, of great benefit to Koch Industries, which is Sam Brownback's financial, big financial back.
KOCH, this is the big oil industry company out of Texas, are you talking
exactly,
about?
The Koch folks, yeah. as right. Brownback calls them, and the folks in his office call them. And so you see this sort of kind of self-serving kind of circle going on there. No one in the family says, hey, we want you to pass the Silk Road Act. What they're doing is making connections.
Amazing. You can read all about it. Well, the book is The Family, and this is one of those rare books that you just absolutely have to buy and read. The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power by Jeff Charlotte. The website, therevealer.org. Jeff, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Excellent, excellent journalism. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes past the hour. By the way, sad news. Senator Edward Kennedy has a malignant brain tumor. This is a glioma, it's referred to, and it's relatively rare. About 9,000 Americans a year get it. The aggressive type has an average survival rate of less than a year. The less aggressive type, around 5 years. We don't know what he has yet. We don't know how they're going to treat it. We don't know what his prognosis is, but it's there. And so... keep him in your prayers or good thoughts. Send him some light, whatever, you know, whatever is your way to do it and deal with it. I think that it's a good and fine thing. So, anyhow, that said, how about a full Monty alert?
Take off your coat. Real slow.
Yeah, last week we talked about the pasty lady.
Baby, take off your shoes. Take your shoes.
Jennifer Moss, who moved on after a year in Ojai.
Baby, take off your dress. Yes, yes, yes.
Moved up to Ashland, Oregon, where it's not illegal to be naked.
You can leave your hat on.
But you can leave your hat on, yeah. Hey, Jennifer Moss is with us. Her website, earthfriendjen.com. Hey, Jennifer.
Hi.
Great to have you with us. You're using nudity as a form of public theater to get attention for good causes. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's one part of it.
Okay. Well, definitely. Tell us about how did you get into that, and what are the other parts of it?
Well, I guess the biggest reason I got into it was human liberation of myself. Mm-hmm. This world does not define me. I define myself.
So you're not going to be Miss Uptight, as it were.
Miss Uptight?
Yeah.
No.
In other words, it's funny because we had like about an hour. In fact, I think it was exactly an hour ago. We had a guy on who said that he was representing a Christian movement who's boycotting Starbucks because their logo is a mermaid and you can see her breasts and her two tails are spread apart. And as if they were legs. And he was just so horrified by this. And you are the extreme other end of the spectrum saying, hey, the body is wonderful. It's beautiful. We should celebrate it. And by the way, let's save the planet.
Yeah. You know, it's sad we live in a world where violence is the norm, where children can play video games all day where they're killing each other, where you can turn on TV and see all kinds of terror and doom. And children in all kinds of cartoons where people are dying and people are getting killed or the animals are killing each other. Mm-hmm. But breastfeeding in public, oh, my God, what an outcry.
Right. Yeah, exactly. or nudity. I mean, you know, public nudity, or for that matter, even open and candid discussions about sexuality, or for that matter, you know, teaching sex ed in schools, and, you know, and on it goes. So
you know, in original innocence, Adam and Eve were naked.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go, in the Bible.
You know, according to this, getting into God, you know, God makes the body. Clothing's made by man.
Yeah.
And that's another big thing. So, yes, it's about human liberation, and it's bringing focus to we need to legalize hemp.
Yeah.
Hemp is a serious thing. It is, you can't even get high off industrial hemp. They put, in 1937, they made this Marijuana Act, where they classified hemp as an illegal drug because it can be, it's such a valuable source and it grows like a weed.
So you're promoting hemp clothing and things like that. You are wearing hemp pasties and
actually the truth of the matter is the G-string I wear.
The G-string was made of hemp. Okay,
yes.
Great.
The rest of it's not all made out of hemp. And some, you know, just like, anyway, like the article by the LA Times was off and certain things were off, but so you got to be careful what you believe.
That's great. Well, Jennifer Moss, you know, I just say good on you and keep up the good work. Keep spreading the good message. The website is earthfriendjen.com. And thanks so much for dropping by and talking with us.
Oh, I wanted to say quickly that we're putting together a peace parade here on 4th of July.
In Ashland?
Because, and we only have to cover our genitals. And it's all about peace because peace starts with ourselves. And a fundamental part of that is our bodies.
Right.
And before we can really create peace in the world, we got to be at peace with our bodies. But, yes, I'll have information on earthfriendjen.com and on MySpace, earthfriendjen. But we're putting together a huge thing here, and it's going to be I'm getting a core group of naked people together.
Yeah, there's a substantial nudist community in that area. I spoke at a conference of theirs about 10 years ago. And are you aligning yourselves with them?
I'm going to, yes. I'm just getting started here. I just moved here May 5th, and actually my birthday's May 29th, and I'm going to put together this little bit, 3 to 4 minutes long, called Eve's Birthday Suit, where I come out on the town naked. It's going to be great. I'll send you the film or whatever, and it's all going to be promoting the Peace Parade. So maybe you all will join us.
Well, maybe. And if you get to Portland, drop by. Earthfriendjen.com is the website, and good luck, Jen.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for dropping by. And looks like at least half the people in the chat room are about to hop on a plane to Ashland, Oregon. Welcome back. We'll be taking your calls after this. I want to play this clip of Cindy Sheehan, and then we'll pick up your phone call.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Ooh. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. TomHartman.com, our website. If you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for all things Air America. And Sean, looking through the list of entries on our blog today, the show blog for TomHartman.com, to see who's going to get an autographed copy of The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child, my most recent ADHD book. We'll be talking about that. But I've been all afternoon all morning, or wherever you are in the country. It's just a little short of noon here in Portland. Have been talking about this one clip that I wanted to play, and then Ellen Ratner is with us. I want to bring her in, but just to finish this. In fact, first of all, Ellen, welcome.
Thank you.
Ellen Ratner is live in the studio with us.
In Oregon.
I am so blessed to have my good
friend. I'm blessed. You, Louise, Sean. I mean, this is a happy group.
And the last time I saw you was when we were in Darfur.
Yeah.
In the Sudan, yeah. Amazing. Well, let me play this. I'd like to get your thoughts on this as well. I had a caller who suggested that the reason Bush was going to bomb Iran was so that there could be such a horrific war in the Middle East that he could declare military law and suspend the elections and thus prevent the prosecution of himself and Condi and all these other war criminals as war criminals after 2009, because Obama has said that he will look into war crimes done by this administration. And I also believe he's going to bomb Iran, but I believe he's going to do it for political purposes, that it's going to be more like pinprick strikes. He's going to get away with it. There won't be any specific, you know, oh, my God, you know, how could he have done
that? I think he's going to get away with it.
Yeah.
But I do think it'll backfire. That's where you and I disagree.
See, I think it's going to energize the McCain, the hard Christian right supporters who want there to be war in the Middle East, you know, to bring back Jesus kind of thing. But anyhow, this is, and we talked about this earlier this morning on the KPOJ. This is Cindy Sheehan testifying under oath in front of John McCain's commission, quoting from Mickey Herskowitz, the author of A Charge to Keep, which is the autobiography of George W. Bush. And here she is.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
Now, when the reporter asked him the other day, the NBC reporter asked him, "Are you going to invade Iran?" Did you catch the smile on his face? You know, and Bush, I mean, I think he thinks that the way to get political power is to have wars.
Oh, clearly he thinks that. And he thinks his father messed up. And I have said, and I think you've said as well, this whole thing to me, having been in mental health for a number of years, is completely Oedipal.
Oedipal. It's all about his mom. It's all about his dad. It's all about
whatever the opposite of Oedipal is called. There's something.
Electra.
The Electra complex. That's right. I think that's really.
He's trying to outdo his father in his mother's eyes. He's. You think that this is about the dynamics in the family?
I think it is completely about the dynamics in the family.
Wow.
And I have felt that from the get-go, and I know people think I'm insane, but.
Well, you know, Jeb was always the good son, and George was always the bad son.
And they always wanted Jeb to be president.
That's right, and Karl Rove short-circuited their plans. I mean, as little as 2 years before 2000, Jeb was the one who signed the Project for New American Century, not George.
Exactly, and I think that he looked around and he said, "How can I beat out Dad, and I'm going to be tougher and meaner and more presidential?"
Right.
And not back down.
Right.
Yeah. And then there's the dynamics of what I call white-knuckle sobriety overlaid with that.
Yeah.
Somebody who has been a drunk but not gone through AA or anything that really sort of puts real spirituality in their life. Now, I know he's found God and all that kind of stuff, but recovery spirituality.
Yeah, he hasn't worked through the stuff associated with all those years of alcoholism. And frankly, there's a clinical condition of a type of brain damage that's associated with long-term severe alcoholism as well, particularly when it starts in adolescence, as George's apparently did. But let's move on from that. You've got a pile of news for us today.
I do. Okay, let's first start out with what I call the get out the popcorn issues. And the House Democratic Committee is having a hearing on Thursday. Conyers is running it on gas prices, retail gas prices. The VP of ExxonMobil is going to be there. The vice chair of Chevron, the U.S. president of Shell, they're all going to be at Conyers Committee, and that's going to be something that
should be
going to be. Yeah, the Department of Justice also did an audit, and they spoke to 1,000. Now, of course, they did their own audit, but still, they spoke to 1,000 FBI agents who said that they left the room. They voiced concerns about the interrogation at military bases outside the United States of quote-unquote detainees, and that they knew that the waterboarding and all other kinds of things were happening, but they refused to participate. Now, whether you believe that or not.
1,000 FBI agents basically said, "No, we won't do this"?
Yes.
Wow.
That is what the
See, those are the things that give me so much hope. I mean, this caller earlier said, Bush is going to declare martial law and suspend the elections. And I said, I don't think Americans would tolerate
it. Not one second.
I really don't believe that he could get away with it. I think even in his own cabinet.
I mean, they used to say that, the right used to say that about Clinton, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So,
I mean, there's always those, our darker spirits, frankly. Let's call them what they are.
The Department of Energy just released a report. CO2 emissions up 1.6% last year. Now, if you think about that, every year, if that was the case, where we would be in 10 or 15 years. And they said it's because of residential and commercial use.
Although a lot of it, actually, we're seeing a massive increase in greenhouse gases because of the thawing of the permafrost.
Right.
Now, a lot of that is methane, not so much of a carbon dioxide, but methane is, I think, 18 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide.
Scary.
Scary stuff. Yeah.
Very scary. Today, we had the Mullen, Joint Chiefs of Staff Mullen was in front of the Budget Committee, and also said that in terms of Guantanamo, he said, frankly, we're stuck, when asked by Dianne Feinstein. And she said that this has really cost us a massive loss of credibility. And he said, problem is that countries will not take their, quote-unquote, detainees back. Also, the budget, just in case you want to know, $515.4 billion this year. That does not include the supplemental, 3.4% of our GDP.
Wow. Wow. Now, John McCain apparently does not realize that Ahmadinejad is not the guy who actually runs Iran.
Right.
And, in fact, we've got the clip here.
Everybody thinks the president runs Iran, and he doesn't.
Right. No, he doesn't. And very much he doesn't. It's a weak presidency.
Kind of like the governorship of Texas was.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, although there isn't somebody over the governor as a singular executive figure, whereas there is in Iran. There is the supreme Ayatollah. And here's John McCain really getting his facts wrong in Savannah, Georgia.
That's the second half of the question. I've done some research and also checked with the Obama campaign, and he's never mentioned Ahmadinejad directly by name. He did say that he would negotiate with the leaders, but as you know,
Ahmadinejad was the leader. Maybe I'm mistaken.
Maybe you are, because the supreme, according to most diplomatic experts, the supreme leader Ali Khamenei is the guy who's in charge of Iranian foreign policy, and also in charge of the nuclear program. But you never mention him. Do you? You know, why do you always keep on talking about Ahmadinejad since he doesn't have power in that realm?
Oh, I think, I respectfully disagree. When he's the person that comes to the United Nations and declares his country's policy is the extermination of the state of Israel, quote, in his words, wipe them off of the map, then I know that he is speaking for the Iranian government and articulating their policy, and he was elected and is running for re-election as the leader of that country. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
One more question on that.
I mean, the fact is, he's the acknowledged leader of that country, and you may disagree, but that's your right to do so. But I think if you asked any average American who the leader of Iran is, I think they'd know. Go ahead.
Yeah. See, basically, what he's saying is that he's as confused as everybody else, Ellen.
Right. Yeah. He did not give a clear answer. He also, at the same speech, talked about the Cuban embargo. Today is Cuban Independence Day. And he said that 5,000 Cubans have been imprisoned for the crime of dangerousness, that tyranny will not forever endure, and because Florida is an important state, the embargo must stay in place.
Yeah, which seems like such a contradiction. I mean, I agree that it is a horrific thing that there are political prisoners in Cuba and that you can't speak out against the Castro regime without going to prison. That is a terrible, terrible
right.
thing.
Not exactly freedom of speech.
Seems to me that the best way to break that open is to undo the embargo and allow trade, allow the families to go back and forth, allow goods and services to go back and forth.
I don't think it's rocket science.
Yeah, no, it's. I mean, that's basically how it's worked in the rest of the world. I mean, arguably the thing that brought down the Berlin Wall was the East Germans seeing West German television. I mean, it was, I used to live there. I could tell you about it. Anyhow, we'll be back with more of Ellen Ratner. with the Talk Radio News Service, live in our studios here in Portland. Tonight we're going to be watching the election coverage together, checking out what's going on. Ellen Radner with Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. And, of course, our website, tomhartman.com, airamerica.com.
Tom Hartman, speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dying, if they said this on the news, they would clarify the picture instead of seeking to confuse. You could see the ice caps melting, if you could watch the oceans rise, you could see the consequences right before your eyes. If you knew the kids were dying, if you could look inside the river where their food comes from, filled with cyanide, if you could hear the parents pleading, if they were looking right at you, if you could see the anguish in their hearts, what if you knew?
Well, I think we do know now. And it's time to tell everybody else. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And we have a winner. Somebody who tickled Sean's fancy. Sean Taylor, our executive producer. She looked over the posts in our blog at tomhartman.com for today's show. And, Sean, what'd you come up with?
Well, there's been lots of fancy tickling going on today. I don't know if this is in response to Mark Dice or to Earth Friend Jen, but it's from Northeast Clark, who says, if in the good Lord had wanted us to strut around buck naked, we would have been born that way. Oh, wait.
Okay, so congratulations once again to
Northeast Clark.
There you go. Congratulations, Northeast Clark. And Northeast Clark is going to get an autographed copy of my most recent book on ADHD titled The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child. And back to Ellen Radner. Ellen, you're still here with us. And actually, let's pick up a couple of phone calls here and bounce
great.
Off them, okay? And then we can get into some other of the news. Let me turn off Sean's mic here so she can go back to typing. And Mark in Oakland, California, listening on Green 960. Mark, you're live with Ellen and me.
Tom, Ellen, it is a pleasure to be with both of you. You've been an inspiration to me over the years.
Thank you.
A couple of points I wanted to make, if I may. Number one, the confluence of events leading up to what possibly will be occurring in Iran is uncontroversible at this moment with the firing of Admiral Fallon, the placement of Petraeus, the release of the documentation regarding the bombing of the Syrian facility, all within virtually that same week or within days of one another.
Yeah, I think Ellen and I both agree with you, Mark.
Beyond belief. Number two, your earlier caller who was speaking about the religious influence in America, one of the issues that brought me as to an absolute activist within our party I've forgotten the name of the gentleman that was the Democratic turncoat who spoke at the 2004 Republican convention.
Mr. Lieberman?
Not Mr.
You're talking
Lieberman.
About Zell Miller.
Zell Miller, that's the one.
Yeah.
He and another congressman in his district were trying to introduce a law that would have, believe it or not, if you don't recall, it was out there, that would have made it illegal for the Supreme Court to overrule any law in the United States that was made at a municipal, county, state, federal level that invoked the Bible in its increase.
No, I am familiar with that, Mark.
Yeah.
I remember it happening, and you know, I don't know. You think Zell was, you know, when he challenged, and thanks for the call, Mark. Ellen, do you think that Zell was losing it?
There is something about becoming an old bat, and that is that sometimes the brain doesn't work terribly well.
Yeah, well, I think that Zell Miller actually is experiencing an organic brain dysfunction.
Well, and the way he lost it, was it on MSNBC?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember that The Daily Show just ran that time and time again. The way he lost it, that is not somebody who has their act together.
No, looking back on it now, it's frankly pretty tragic. Your thoughts on Mark's comments about the war?
Well, I mean, my view is that we, you know, as we've been talking, we're going to we're going to be aggressive here.
Mm-hmm.
And although that actually gets into some news, because today they're saying in Congress at the hearing, Mullen is saying there's been an increase in violence in Afghanistan, receding in Iraq, but not really.
That's, so violence is receding in Iraq because what, we're paying a few more Shiites not to shoot at us? Or we're helping the Sunnis, we're paying a few more Sunnis not to shoot at us.
And we're helping the Shiites.
Right, we're helping the Shiites actually align themselves more tightly with Iran.
And then we're going to, you know, go after Iran. I mean, we're playing this puzzle. We're playing God over there.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You just can't do that with countries.
Can't
do it with people either.
We're doing it poorly.
Yes.
Doing it very poorly. And I'm just, you know, if Bush does anything that is perceived as significant. I mean, you know, if he takes out one facility and says, oh, it was a nuclear facility, and he can get most of the world's major leaders to defend him or something like
right.
that. Maybe,
showing tubes or something.
Yeah, maybe not a lot of fallout. But if he takes out something and hundreds of people die and Al Jazeera gets the photos or the Iranian National News Service gets the photos and they spread all over the world of dead people and dead children in the streets, there's going to be hell to pay among the Shiites in Iraq. I mean, our soldiers could find themselves...
Well, but there's also economic fallout, and the advantage of us being part-time in Dubai is that, you know, I see the Iranian bank, which has a skyscraper there. Not skyscraper,
right.
But a very tall, beautiful, modern building.
Right.
Iranian banks in many, many corners. I mean, there is a confluence there.
We could see oil go to $200 a barrel. We could see gold go to $2,000 an ounce. We could see the dollar fall to you know, 20 cents against the euro.
Well, that's why, actually, there was a hearing today on the dollar. On commodities, including why food prices are going up. And one of the people testifying said there are five reasons. And the first one is the weakening U.S. dollar.
Yeah. Well, that's what the king of Saudi Arabia said to George Bush day before yesterday or 3 days ago. He said, you know, you've got to get your dollar under control. And this has been the policy of the Bush administration, is destroy the value of the dollar so you can pay back all that debt that Reagan, Bush Sr. and Bush Jr. borrowed with depreciated dollars. It's the strategy that the Germans followed after World War II to repay the Treaty of Versailles debt.
Oh. And it's going to get us nowhere in the long run.
Oh, it's just destroying the middle class. Ellen Ratner, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks so much, Ellen, for
Thank
being
you.
Here. It's great to see you again in person. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com, about the issues of the day. We'll be talking about the Oregon and Kentucky primaries happening this afternoon. Plus, Stephen Fry. Dr. Stephen Fry is going to drop by telling us why 25 reasons to legalize drugs. That and the best of the rest of the news and your calls. And don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it! Get out there, get active. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great one.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.